From Ashes to Desire, The Birth of Lipstick Films. From Ashes to Desire, The Birth of Lipstick Films. Before Sally passed, during those raw, uncertain days in rehab, another shadow loomed. I'd fallen foul of the V8 office. Years earlier, I'd diverted funds earmarked for the government to help pay for her surgeries in the U.S. I had informed them, pleaded even, laying out the situation with brutal honesty. But bureaucracy is cold, and 4 years later, the debt still stood, now armed with threats of court proceedings. On the advice of a financial consultant, I agreed to go bankrupt, voluntary, clean slate. But before the paperwork could be finalized, the unthinkable happened. Sally died. Her death shattered me, but in a cruel twist of fate, the life insurance pays out cleared all the debts down to the last penny, interest included. I was left with £13,000 and a heavy, hollow victory. No steady income, a mortgage that didn't care about grief. But I still believed in what we were building. I owned 25% of IFL, and somehow, that flicker of hope kept me upright. Then, one morning, I walked into the office to find Andrew practically vibrating with excitement. He had something to show me. The night before, he'd recorded a Channel 5 documentary titled Sex and Shopping, and it had lit a fire in him. It explored the booming pornography industry across Europe and the U.S., where hardcore content was not just legal but wildly profitable. Meanwhile, the U.K. lagged, crippled by outdated censorship laws that only allowed softcore material. Andrew had been taking notes. He rattled off names. David Sullivan, David Gold, titans of adult media who had built empires from racy magazines like White House, Raider, and Hustler, and extended their reach through ventures like the Sport newspaper, Ann Summers, and Knickerbox. By the late 70s, they dominated over half the UK's adult print market and ran more than 150 shops, some offering massage services behind discreet curtains. He showed me another Channel 5 show, Sex Cetera, an American news magazine from Playboy TV that examined sexuality in all its forms. But it was the European film franchise Bend Over that really caught his eye. British actors starring in hardcore films shot in England but distributed across Europe and the US, skirting UK laws. That's where the real money was, he said. I laughed. Surely he was joking. But Andrew leaned in, eyes gleaming. Sex has been a business for thousands of years. Prostitution is called the world's oldest profession for a reason. He cited David Sullivan, again convicted of profiting from immoral earnings, but out in 71 days. He never denied his past, Andrew said. He believed he brought people happiness. We're not selling weapons or cigarettes. We're giving adults freedom. When he put it that way, I stopped laughing. We were in. We named the venture Lipstick Films. I suggested we broaden the empire by capitalizing on the massage parlors and underground brothels already operating in London's shadows. The internet was exploding. Why not bring it all online? I recalled Holland's red light district, laughing as I told Andrew about the time I pulled a sink off a brothel wall in a panic and bolted. But what struck me wasn't just the comedy, it was the transparency. In Amsterdam, sex work was open, honest. In the UK, it was veiled in secrecy. So we created a site, GView, a digital red light district, offering monthly subscriptions and discreet booking services for men seeking companionship. We began cold calling. After weeks of outreach, 50 women joined the platform, from massage parlor regulars to dominatrices operating from home. For the first time in months, money began to trickle in. IFL, our legitimate, morally safe venture, was put on the back burner. For now, sex was paying the bills. To fuel Lipstick Films, we needed actors. Andrew had already written scripts. I suggested placing an ad in The Stage, the UK's performing arts bible. UK adult film production company seeking British actors for exclusive distribution in European and US markets. The response was immediate. Within days, our office was swamped. Letters, headshots, emails from men and women of all ages, shapes, and skin tones. Andrew had already triaged the submissions into three piles. Definite, maybes, and never in a million years. To cover our backs, he drafted a tight legal waiver. Full consent, no future claims, zero rights to the material. Every applicant had to sign it. We rented the studio next door for casting sessions. Conveniently, my parents were downsizing and eager to get rid of their old sofas. We repurposed them, our first casting couches. When we told our cameraman Mark that we were shelving IFL and pivoting into adult films, I expected outrage. Instead, he just nodded. Andrew grinned. Everyone's interested in sex, he said. And he was right. We met a parade of personalities, some nervous, some natural, some unforgettable. Andrew had a gift for branding. He named our most reliable male performer, thin, quiet, but capable of delivering on cue every time, Arthur Cumalot. Then there was Chuck, a blonde, statuesque South African with abs like Greek marble. Andrew christened him Storm, already imagining titles, Storm Cuming, Storm Troopers, In the Eye of the Storm. We were in production. Lipstick Films was alive. We worked in secrecy, blinds drawn, doors locked, editing sessions done late into the night. By then we had two finished films, adult auditions of UK housewives, filmed dirt cheap using unpaid cast. But to grow, we needed new locations, better sets. And that meant more money. G-View was pulling in £500 a month. Not bad, but nowhere near enough. So we ran another ad, this time in the South London Press. Locations needed for adult film production. Seeking English settings for European and American markets. Immediate response requested. The response was overwhelming. Within 24 hours, our phones lit up. Letters poured in. People offered everything from suburban homes to dungeons. One dominatrix invited us to use her fully equipped playroom and star in the film. We secured a pool house in Mottingham, a flat in Battersea, a hair salon on King's Road, even a yacht in Littlehampton. A couple in Kent offered their barn and farmhouse and insisted on watching the filming, promising tea and sandwiches for the cast. Once again, Andrew's words echoed in my mind, everyone is interested in sex. And as strange as it all felt, standing in suburban living rooms imagining camera angles for a scene called British MILFs Take Tea and More, I realized something. We were no longer surviving. We were thriving. Although we had been offered a range of filming locations, every option came with a price tag. Nothing was free anymore. Even the actors in our portfolio, once willing collaborators, were no longer available without compensation. Everyone needed to be paid, including us. We narrowed our focus to two prime locations, a house in Mottingham with a pool and a sleek hairdressing salon on King's Road. The latter, we believed, offered more than just aesthetics. It anchored the film in a familiar London setting, something that could resonate deeply with both European and American audiences. At the time, I was still seeing Diane. I had recently whisked her away to Venice for her birthday, our first time there. If you've never been, go. The magic is real. I remember flying into Marco Polo Airport, expecting a typical taxi ride to our hotel. But as we stepped into arrivals, a swarm of boatmen descended on us, offering water taxis. I brushed them off, certain it was a tourist trap, while Diane whispered, half-joking, that we'd end up robbed and floating face down in the Adriatic. Yet as we watched other travelers board without hesitation, we caved. Moments later, gliding across the still dark waters, the city's silhouette emerged like a dream from the mist. We felt like extras in a Bond film. That weekend was perfect. Sunset dinners, hidden alleyways, and quiet moments that made me believe we might really be building something lasting. It was during that trip I decided to tell her the truth. While still working with Andrew at IFL, I had quietly stepped into producing hardcore adult films. Not just behind the scenes, I was in the room, camera in hand, filming live, unfiltered scenes. Once, during what was meant to be a rehearsal, 8 eager performers launched into an impromptu orgy. Naturally, we kept the cameras rolling. I braced for Diane's judgment, but she surprised me. "It's business," she said coolly. "You're not part of it. You're just documenting." She even admitted her own brush with the adult industry, hosting Ann Summers parties, selling lingerie and sex toys at house gatherings. "Sex sells," she told me with a shrug. When we got back to London, she stunned me again. She handed Andrew and me £4,000 in cash, enough to bankroll our first 2 professional shoots. Just like that, we were in business. We ended up with 6 polished VHS tapes, each featuring British talent in raw, explicit scenes, ready for export. What we needed now was a serious distributor. My research led me to a giant in the industry, Beta USA. But Bay USA wasn't just a brand, she was a legend. Born in 1919 in East Prussia, she had the guts of a pioneer. Inspired by the myth of Icarus, she learned to fly at 17 and by 18 was one of Germany's first female stunt pilots. During World War II, she flew combat aircraft for the Luftwaffe, Junkers, Messerschmitts, the works. But when the war ended, her wings were clipped. No job, no prospects, just hunger and rubble, she turned to survival. First, the black market. Then, a breakthrough, realizing that post-war German women were desperate for birth control advice. Drawing on her mother's medical teachings, Beat wrote a pamphlet on the rhythm method. It sold over 32,000 copies. That small success snowballed into a mail-order business. Condoms, sex education books, and eventually, in 1962, the world's first sex shop. She endured over 2,000 court cases, fought moral outrage, and bulldozed through outdated legislation. By 1999, her company was listed on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. She passed away in 2001, but by then, she had redefined the sexual landscape of Europe. Her name meant trust, quality, and fearless disruption. We knew we had to get her attention. We edited a sharp 3-minute promotional video featuring our best scenes and 6 titles. I mailed it directly to her. A few days later, we received an email. They were in. The offer was clean. Each VHS would feature 2 films. They wanted the masters. They'd handle everything else. Duplication, packaging, distribution. They offered £3,000 up front for the first 1,000 units. For every additional 1,000 sold, another £3,000. It broke down to £1.50 per film, but with 6 films, we'd pocket £9,000 just for handing over 3 master tapes. The only catch was a 1-year exclusivity clause. No other distributors. I saw no downside. It was legal, scalable, and Beta USA had reach. All we had to do was create. But Andrew saw it differently. He was furious. When he discovered that our tapes were retailing for £60 each in European shops, he felt cheated. To him, £1.50 per film was an insult. He wanted control, full control. His plan? Cut out the middleman. We'd sell directly in the UK, undercutting Europe by offering the tapes at £20 a pop. I resisted. He insisted. He shut down production and pivoted us into sales. I went to Currys and bought 8 VCRs, then picked up shelving from IKEA. We stacked the machines 2 per shelf, wired them to our 2 Canon camcorders, and started duplicating. We designed slick VHS sleeves using Corkspress and bought cases in bulk. We loaded 1 film per tape, maximizing price per unit. Before long, we had crates of content ready to ship. The challenge now? Moving them. Cold calling newsagents was out. I refused. Instead, we turned to local newspaper classifieds. The ad was simple. Good quality soft porn videos for sale. Call 782543 for details. The response was overwhelming. On the phone, we pitched the softcore tapes at £10 each, but hinted at something more. We've also got a handful of hardcore titles. Filmed in London, never seen in the UK. Normally £60 in Europe, but we'll do them for £20 each. Or all 8 for £150 with a bonus softcore film. It worked. Orders flooded in. Every night we packed tapes, and every day I was back on the road. Lewisham, Bromley, Deptford, Woolwich, delivering to every corner of South and East London. I met everyone. Lonely men in decrepit tower blocks, couples in spotless suburban homes, retirees, students, businessmen. The one unifying thread, everyone wanted sex. Even as the moral fog around the business deepened, the money brought stability. Things at home improved. Diane and I were growing stronger, talking about moving in together. She had recently won a malpractice settlement from the NHS after a botched surgery, a windfall she planned to invest in her children's futures. Her son Theo often visited his father in Eastbourne, while Caitlin stayed with Diane. Caitlin and Remy became fast friends. My house in Old Road became a hub. On weekends, it overflowed with laughter as Caitlin, Ben, Remy, Josh, and Luke played together like siblings. Luke, Remy's close friend, lived with his grandmother Audrey and her partner Sonny, a warm-hearted Jamaican man. After Sonny's death, coinciding with Sally's passing, Luke became a fixture in our home. Audrey was aging, and I felt it a duty to help. I brought them into our fold, sharing meals, holidays, routines. Ben, meanwhile, was spiraling. Now at Eltham Green, he was bullied, isolated, angry. Eventually, he was expelled. For nearly a year, he had no school. I couldn't leave him alone, but I couldn't stay home either. Then I had an idea. Ben loved animals. Why not a job with horses? I approached the local stables in Mottingham, offered to pay them if they'd give him a trial. They agreed. On his first day, I got a call from the owner. We need to talk. I drove there bracing for the worst. Instead, I was told that Ben had been nearly crushed when a startled horse pinned him against a stable wall. But he stayed calm, he soothed the horse, stayed still, and earned its trust. The staff were amazed. They offered him a long-term apprenticeship on the spot. Around this time, I encouraged Diane to consider buying her council house. Thanks to her settlement and the right to buy discount, it was feasible. She agreed. I introduced her to mortgage brokers, and we began to imagine a real future. A joined household, a family, our own version of the Brady Bunch. My home, originally bought with Sally, became the heart of this dream. Diane and I began redesigning it. More rooms, better spaces. We hired builders, discovered dry rot, got it covered by insurance. While official contractors handled the rot upstairs, Martin worked downstairs installing a 6-burner gas hob. One afternoon, Diane and I went to B&Q in Charlton to shop for lights. She noticed the bulbs were sold separately and began slipping them into our chosen lamp boxes. I protested. She told me to shut up. Then my phone rang. A friend called. Fire engines were outside our house. Before we could escape B&Q, just as our nerves began to fray with urgency, a security guard appeared, stone-faced and unwavering. "Come with me," he said, ushering us into a small windowless office. There, on a flickering CCTV monitor, was the incriminating footage, Diane calmly unscrewing light bulbs from their packaging, my own hesitant figure hovering beside her, clearly uneasy, clearly complicit. The evidence was irrefutable. I leaned forward, my voice tight with panic. "Please, we must go. There's a fire. Our house might be burning down as we speak." He studied us for a long moment, weighing protocol against desperation. Finally, he exhaled and said, "Go, but don't come back. No charges. Just a warning." We didn't wait for a second invitation. We tore out of the store and raced home through traffic, my heart pounding. As we turned onto our street, the unmistakable chaos of an emergency scene came into view. Fire trucks, flashing lights, a crowd gathered in a loose semicircle. The unmistakable stench of burnt wood clung to the air. Inside the house, it had all unfolded in seconds. Martin, mid-renovation, had been cutting through the floorboards when his blade kissed an unseen gas pipe buried beneath the boards. A hiss of escaping gas, a flicker, then boom. A fireball erupted with terrifying speed, snaking its way down the hall like a living thing. Flames licked the staircase. Upstairs, one of the insurance builders spotted the inferno below. Without hesitation, he shouted a warning, grabbing his colleagues and ushering them across the street to safety. In the thickening smoke, Martin's saw struck a second pipe, this time water. A geyser exploded from beneath the floor, jets of scalding steam hissing violently into the air, mingling with the black smoke in a surreal storm of fire and vapor. The fire brigade arrived swiftly, storming into the house in full gear, axes and hoses at the ready. But the worst had already passed. In a bizarre twist of fate, the water pipe had done what the fire alarm couldn't. It had doused the blaze before it could truly take hold. The damage was minimal, charred boards, scorched paint, but the structure had held. No one was hurt. Martin, singed and soaked, stumbled outside, his face a mosaic of embarrassment and adrenaline. A small crowd of neighbors had gathered to gawk, whispering and pointing. Diane and I arrived just in time to see Martin, red-faced, explaining to the fire chief what had happened. When he saw us, he offered a sheepish shrug. "I found the stopcocks," he said, his voice hoarse but relieved. We stood together on the pavement, hearts still hammering, breathing in the acrid scent of near disaster. The house had survived. Everyone was safe. Martin's pride might have taken a hit, but the rest could be patched up. And somehow, through the pandemonium, the underground film empire, the school battles, the legal tightropes, and now, flaming renovations, we kept moving forward. We were building more than walls. We were building a life, a family, a future. After a few months of steady, lucrative sales, we expanded our production line to 16 VCRs, adding another identical shelving unit from IKEA. But the strain was starting to show, literally. The constant usage was wearing out the VCR heads, causing a noticeable decline in video quality and leading to higher maintenance costs. Although we were moving units, I still wasn't convinced this was the right path. We were nowhere near the £9,000 we could have earned from just two of our films on a single master copy, distributed through Beata USA. More than anything, I missed the excitement of being on location, filming. The camaraderie, the unpredictable moments, the creative energy, it had all vanished. Many of the actors we had worked with had become friends, and they were growing restless. They couldn't understand why Lipstick Films had suddenly gone quiet. Unbeknownst to them, we had diverted our focus from production to direct distribution in South London. They assumed our films were being shipped off to Europe. One morning took an unexpected turn. James, the landlord of the building next door, the same one where we had originally set up our studio and held auditions, had recently rented out the fully furnished boudoir to a young, working girl and her dim-witted thug of a boyfriend, who also acted as her pimp. The two lived and worked out of the premises. That morning, Andrew and I were at Charlie's Cafe, enjoying a late breakfast, when chaos suddenly erupted outside. A swarm of armed Kent police officers descended on the building next door. We watched in shock as the girl and her boyfriend were handcuffed, separated, and bundled into different police cars before being driven away. Meanwhile, a small team of officers, dressed in white forensic jumpsuits, remained behind, carefully combing through the studio. A short while later, a sharply dressed young officer knocked on our door. "Excuse me, sir, we found these next door. We believe they belong to you." He handed over a stack of business cards. "My name, Asen Jamil, production manager, Lipstick Films," was printed on one. Andrew's card read, "Andrew Simmons, CEO and production manager, Lipstick Films." At the time, we operated discreetly under the IFL, Information Film Library name, keeping up appearances so that anyone walking by assumed we were simply running a standard media business. Andrew remained composed. He openly admitted that the cards were ours and explained that IFL was simply our secondary company. He went on to detail our work in the adult film industry, how profitable it was, and how our focus was strictly on legal distribution to Europe and America. Conveniently, we had already packed up our equipment. Our VCRs were stashed in the boot of Andrew's car. Then we asked the officer what had happened. "A body was found in the boot of a car at an industrial site in Gravesend," he explained. "The car belonged to the girl's boyfriend. We're certain there was no foul play. The coroner confirmed there were no significant injuries. Looks like a heart attack." As it turned out, the deceased was one of the girl's clients. He had suffered a fatal heart attack mid-session. Panicked, the boyfriend had taken it upon himself to dispose of the body. He shoved the corpse into the boot of his car, drove to Gravesend, abandoned the vehicle, and simply walked away. Andrew and I exchanged glances, both shocked yet fascinated by how bizarre the situation was. After expressing our condolences, Andrew, ever the opportunist, saw an angle. "You know," he said to the officer, "we're always on the lookout for compelling stories to film. If Kent Police were open to it, we'd love to put together a crew to shadow your team for a few days, day and night. I'm sure it'd make for gripping viewing." The officer seemed intrigued. He mentioned that his superior might be interested and was confident he could get clearance from higher-ups. He took our business cards, assured us that we weren't under any suspicion, and left. But the drama didn't end there. Later that week, with the commotion next door finally dying down, I sat at my desk, organizing addresses for the afternoon's deliveries. Andrew had just returned from the shop with two cups of tea. In his haste, he had forgotten to lock the door, something we always did when handling Lipstick business. Suddenly, the front door burst open. A huge, mean-looking man stormed in, brandishing what looked like a sawn-off shotgun. My blood ran cold as he pointed it directly at me. Behind him walked a shorter, wiry man with a thick Cockney accent, a cigar clenched between his teeth. "Is this the HQ for Lipstick Films?" he demanded. I couldn't answer. "You're on my patch," he continued, exhaling a thick cloud of smoke. "I own all of South London. If you value your kneecaps, you'll stop distributing these films immediately, and as compensation, you're going to give me £1,000 now." There was no room for negotiation. Fortunately, we had the cash on hand. Without hesitation, we handed it over. Before leaving, he shot us one final warning. "If I hear you're still selling, you won't be walking anywhere, understand?" And with that, he was gone, leaving us rattled, £1,000 lighter, and with a stark reminder that we were playing in a world with its own set of rules. I was so shaken that I left the office and went straight to Diane's house. My children were still at school, and I desperately needed someone to talk to. She listened calmly as I vented. After the dry rot repairs were completed, we decided to continue improving the house. Martin and Fred worked together to reconfigure the layout, pushing the bathroom wall into our bedroom, which, being quite large, could afford to lose some space. This adjustment allowed for one of the smaller bedrooms to be expanded by extending its wall into part of the former bathroom area. This newly enlarged space would become Theo's room. For the other small bedroom, Martin designed a creative solution. A raised bed at head height, with a study area and wardrobe built underneath, accessed by a set of stairs leading up to the elevated sleeping platform. Andrew introduced us to a highly skilled carpenter, Mr. Ruffton, a Geordie who had beautifully crafted his kitchen at his home near Shooter's Hill in Blackheath. We were also considering a loft conversion, and after meeting Mr. Ruffton and seeing his impressive hand-drawn designs, we agreed to hire him for the job. At the time, Mr. Ruffton was already working on a loft conversion for Andrew, but since our renovations were essential to accommodate Diane and her family, Andrew generously agreed to let Mr. Ruffton prioritize our project, if the carpenter was willing. Diane, recognizing that these changes were mainly for her family's benefit, offered to cover the cost, especially since I wasn't yet earning enough to contribute substantially. However, despite his undeniable talent, Mr. Five, Ruffton proved to be highly unreliable. He would disappear for weeks without warning, then suddenly reappear, sleep in his car, work in the loft for a few days, and then vanish again, only to return on a Monday after spending the weekend back in Newcastle. The loft conversion dragged on for months. One evening, while Mr. Ruffton was working on our loft, Andrew arrived at my doorstep, furious. He demanded to see the carpenter, and upon confronting him, erupted in a rage, shouting he ordered Mr. Ruffton to leave our project immediately and return to finish the work at his home. When Mr. Ruffton refused, insisting that he was owed more money, Andrew's anger escalated. In a shocking turn, he pulled a gun from the waistband of his trousers, brandishing it in Mr. Ruffton's face. His voice boomed with fury as he forced the terrified carpenter down the stairs and out the front door. Then, shockingly, he popped the boot of his Mercedes, shoved Ruffton inside, and sped off. Before leaving, he turned to me, grinning. Sorry, mate. Needed sorting. I stood there, stunned and furious, struggling to process what I had just witnessed days earlier at the office in Greenwich and the reality of the world Andrew was dragging me into. Several days passed before I finally returned to our offices on Lassell Street. I had made up my mind. I was going to confront Andrew. I was deeply unsettled, not just by witnessing his ruthless methods, but also by the threats we had received from the infamous South London underworld figure, the so-called Porn King. His message had been crystal clear. If we continued duplicating and selling films instead of producing new content, we would be kneecapped. However, I believe there could be an alternative. If price was our issue, we should take our films directly to the red light district in Amsterdam and try to strike deals with adult stores. We could handle our own duplication and distribution, selling them for £20 per copy, which would still leave retailers with a generous profit, given that they were selling them for £60. To my surprise, my absence had given Andrew time to reflect, or perhaps, like me, he had been shaken by the kneecap threat. I never knew for sure. But when I brought up the idea of finding a better, more legitimate distributor, he agreed. With that, we set about copying a sample video we had previously produced for Bea Usa and headed to Amsterdam. Upon arriving, we decided to split up, covering more ground and meeting back later at the Grasshopper Inn to compare results. My efforts proved promising. I received positive responses from several adult shops, with modest orders of 10 to 20 copies per store. They agreed to pay our £20 per unit and assured me they would reorder promptly if sales went well. During my rounds, I stumbled upon a massive adult store, more akin to a Tesco Metro or a Sainsbury's local in size. It was called Scala, a one-stop shop for everything erotic and a powerhouse in international distribution. They specialized in adult products, from toys and lingerie to films, serving retailers, wholesalers, and online marketplaces worldwide. With over 48 years of industry experience, they had built a reputation as a trusted name in the business. The store manager, intrigued by our films, was eager for me to meet their head buyer. Unfortunately, he wouldn't be available until the next day, but the manager was confident he would place large orders, potentially in the hundreds, on a regular basis. I was thrilled. With orders already in hand and an important meeting scheduled for the next day, I knew we needed to stay overnight. I called Audrey, Luke's grandmother, and asked if she'd mind staying at my house to keep an eye on the boys. She agreed, and everything seemed to be falling into place. Eager to share the good news, I went to find Andrew. But when we met, I was in for a shock. Instead of focusing on selling, Andrew had gone on a shopping spree, spending all our cash to buy a huge selection of adult videos, covering everything from heterosexual content to gay films. He had made a bold decision. He no longer cared about the so-called porn king or his threats. The demand for fresh material was too high, and Andrew saw an easy opportunity to generate fast revenue by copying and selling these newly acquired films. But his reckless spending had left us broke. There was no money left for a hotel, and he was eager to get back to the UK immediately to resume production. Furious, I felt completely sidelined. Once again, he had ignored our plan and decided without consulting me. This was the final straw. I told him that if this was the direction he wanted to take, I was out. I had no interest in continuing. The moment we got back to the UK, I was walking away for good. Surprisingly, he agreed. And that was it. I was done. We set off for Calais beneath a heavy sky, the car thick with silence. Not the comfortable kind, but the brittle, suffocating quiet that makes every mile feel longer than the last. Neither of us spoke. There was nothing left to say. The only sound was the steady hum of the engine and the occasional swish of tires against the wet road. My eyes fixed on the horizon, willing the miles to disappear. By the time we rolled onto the ferry, the air between us was like glass, fragile and ready to shatter. I stood on deck as Calais slipped away, the cold wind stinging my face, and felt nothing but the urgent need to reach Dover. The sooner we crossed the channel, the sooner the car carried us home, the sooner we could part ways. That was all that mattered now, the speed of our separation. No sooner had we eased the car through the nothing to declare exit than a customs officer stepped into our path. His arm raised like a judge delivering a sentence. My stomach sank. Within minutes, the boot was open, and the damning stacks of adult films Andrew had so casually purchased were laid bare under the sterile fluorescent lights of the inspection bay. Everything moved in a blur after that. We were separated without ceremony, ushered down different corridors like suspects in a crime. I found myself alone in a small windowless room, the ticking clock on the wall taunting me with every passing second. Time thickened, slowed, until each minute felt like an hour. My mind spun with panic. What exactly had Andrew bought? Were these tapes just explicit, or something darker, something illegal? God, let there be no animals, nothing obscene, nothing that would damn us beyond repair. When they finally summoned me, the interrogation felt surreal. A gray-faced officer fixed me with an unblinking stare and fired questions like bullets. Who are you? What's your connection to this material? What do you intend to do with it? I swallowed hard and told the truth. We were Lipstick Films, a legitimate production company working between Europe and the U.S. The tapes we carried, at least the ones we had produced, were sample reels, previews of our own content. As for Andrew's purchases, I framed them as research, though the word felt paper thin in my mouth. Still, I had already resigned myself to the outcome. Charges felt inevitable. I remember thinking, this is it. This is the end. How will I explain this to anyone? A strange calm washed over me in that moment, the kind that comes only when you know you've reached the breaking point. My decision to leave the business had never felt more certain. And then, against all odds, the script flipped. The customs officers released us. It turned out Dover Customs had long ties with Kent Police, and Lipstick Films was already on their radar. They knew of us. Our name still lingered in their files, tied to the sordid case of our neighbor's boyfriend who had hidden a dead body in Greenwich after one of his girlfriend's entertainments ended in a fatal heart attack. After confiscating every last tape, they simply let us walk. No charges, no trial, just silence and the bitter taste of humiliation. That day was the end for me. I never again set foot in our LaSalle Street offices. I never saw Andrew after that. But even now, every so often, I find myself wondering, where did he end up? Did the business devour him too? or did he find a way to survive it?